You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Tax Planning for Real Estate, Part 1. I'm pleased to introduce our speakers today. Joining us from Chicago is Anthony Licata. Mr. Licata is a partner at Taft, Stettinius & Hollister, LLP, where he formerly chaired the firm's real estate practice. He has an extensive practice focusing on major commercial real estate transactions, including finance, development, leasing, and land use. He formerly served as an adjunct professor at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University and at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Mr. Licata will serve as the discussion leader of today's program. Also joining us from Chicago is Rick Aderman. Mr. Aderman is a partner with Taft, Stettinius & Hollister, LLP, where his practice focuses on the tax consequences of complex real estate and business transactions, including mergers and acquisitions, capital raising, debt offerings, and other major transactions. He has special expertise in analyzing the tax consequences of real estate developments, sales, and leasing. Mr. Licata, I hand the program to you.
Thank you and welcome everyone. It's always a great pleasure to participate in a program for the Professional Education Broadcast Network. And today I think we have a good program lined up for you. Today, this session is the first of two parts in which Rick Aderman and I will be discussing tax aspects of planning and investing in real estate projects. Today, in the first program, we are going to focus on choice of entity considerations. We're going to talk about understanding the allocations of tax and economic attributes in the entity once you've selected it. And then we're going to shift over and talk about like-kind exchanges generally, but more specifically about some of the advanced issues that we come up against in the topic of like-kind exchanges. So, Rick, let's get started. With respect to choice of entity, obviously you could pick from sole proprietorship if there's only one individual, but most real estate deals, particularly larger real estate deals, have investor groups put together. And so that would lead you, as a general rule, with choosing between a limited partnership, a general partnership, a limited liability company, or a subchapter S corporation, which of course is a corporation which is more or less not taxed at the corporate level, or a C corporation in which you have tax both at the corporate level, income tax both at the corporate level and the shareholder level. So walk us through a little bit, Rick, of your thinking about, and I'll cut to the chase. We almost always end up at the LLC structure, but walk us through why that would be the conclusion that we almost always reach.
Sure. So outside of the real estate industry area, the choice of entity can be much more complicated. And that became even trickier after the most recent tax bill, which reduced C corporate tax rates from a top rate of 35% to a flat 21% rate. So outside of the real estate area, we spent a lot of time thinking through the pros and cons of whether you want to be a C corporation, an S corporation, or an entity tax as a partnership. But in the real estate area, because of certain special rules that apply only to real estate, most especially the ability to deduct depreciation deductions on the real estate that's funded by debt, which in non-real estate deals you generally cannot do if the debt is not recourse to the members. Because of the ability to do that, you generally, in a real estate transaction, want to be a partnership. Now, if you're going to be very widely held and you're a specialized expertise and you want to be a real estate investment trust, you might want to form a REIT. But those are very expensive to administer because of a lot of technical rules that apply to be maintaining a REIT. So for most people, it's not practical to form your entity as a REIT.
Especially if you have a single asset transaction. REITs tend to make more sense if you have a broad range of a portfolio, multiple assets. And really, REIT discussion is sort of beyond our scope today. You could do programs on all sorts of REIT aspects alone.
Right.
So let's focus in. And also, Rick, let's emphasize, if we may, that for tax purposes, limited liability companies are taxed as the partnership rules under subchapter K, I think it is, of the tax code.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So once you've eliminated being a C corp or an S corp because you don't want to lose the ability to take those deductions, you're not going to be a REIT because it's just too complicated and too expensive for the nature of your project. So you decide that for tax purposes, you want to be a partnership. Once you make that decision, as Tony had mentioned earlier, you can form as a state law entity. You can either be a general partnership, or a limited liability company. For non-tax reasons, most people will select to be a limited liability company because it allows you to have complete limited liability for all of the owners, including the people running the deal. So if you form a limited partnership, somebody has to be the general partner, who generally is subject to unlimited liability with respect to all of the liabilities of the entity, of the partnership. Now, they do, most recently, they have developed limited liability, limited partnerships. But, people, that came into being well after LLCs became entrenched. And so most people just stick with the LLC structure, even though you can get a similar result from a limited liability partnership or a limited liability limited partnership. So once you've made that decision to be a partnership for tax purposes, you realize very quickly that the most sensible entity to form is your limited liability company. And I think that I've heard that there are now more LLCs being formed in the country than corporations.
Yeah. So, Rick, talk for just a second. We alluded to it briefly, but the one of the key factors that different for tax purposes differentiating limited liability companies / partnerships from corporate form is this issue of being able to take depreciation deductions based upon a value of the property that includes debt. In other words, if you buy a property for $100, you put in $20 of your own money and borrow $80, you take that $100 and you have to allocate some portion of that to the land. But let's just say you allocate $10 to the land and $90 to the building, then you get to take depreciation as a deduction against your income from the property based on the $90 value, not just the $20 equity portion of the value. So given that, take a minute to talk us through why that is so critically important. And that fact alone is what pushes real estate deals, I think, towards this LLC structure.
Yeah, so I won't go into too much detail yet because our next program, there's a whole section on the at-risk rules, and this issue really is the most important element of the at-risk rules with respect to real estate. But part of the reason that we choose to be a partnership for tax purposes, as I said earlier, is because of this ability to take these depreciation deductions. And the reason for that, as I'll talk in more detail in the second program in the next hour, is that there's a special rule in the tax code that allows you to treat non-recourse debt, certain types of non-recourse debt on real estate, as if it is recourse to the members for purposes of taking depreciation deductions on the real estate. And that's a large economic benefit to the owners which they would not be able to take if it were an S corporation, and certainly not if it were a C corporation.
Right.
But even an S corporation, where you're generally allowed to take, where the deductions of the company generally flow through to the shareholders, these deductions in an S corp would not flow through, whereas in a partnership they do, and the partners or members of the LLC taxed as a partnership do get to take their pro rata share of those deductions.
So, Rick, sticking with my example from just a minute ago, we have a building that we bought. We have a building and land that we bought for $100. We've allocated 10 to the land, 90 to the building. Over what period of time do we get to take those depreciation deductions on the $90? Because we're treating the 80 of debt as part of the basis in the building.
Right. So
what's the tell us,
there's residential real estate and non-residential real estate. Typically, residential real estate is 30 years, non-residential 40 years. There is some ability to shorten those periods by a couple years, but you usually don't want to do that,
right?
Because there are new rules, again, that came in the last Tax Act, effective in 2018, that can limit your interest deductions if you try to take any sort of accelerated depreciation. Again, the acceleration is only a few years anyways. So most real estate partnerships choose to take the standard depreciation schedule so that they avoid those rules that could limit their use of interest deductions.
So historically what happens in this, again using this example of depreciating on a $90 basis, if you have debt and you're paying interest on the debt, that interest is an expense that generally is deductible against the rental income. You add to it the deductible expense of the depreciation deduction, which is a non-cash deduction. You don't write a check to anybody for that. It is a tax deduction. So in the case of our $90 building, using a 30-year depreciation, you get to deduct $3 a year for a depreciation expense. And if your interest and your other expenses are gobbling up most of your rental income, you will have the opportunity, because of the depreciation deduction, to, at a minimum almost, have whatever cash flow is left over after your interest and your expenses. That cash flow tends to be tax-free, in effect, because it's sheltered, if you will, by the depreciation deduction. And in some cases, you have a taxable loss, which is not an economic loss because, the depreciation deduction is not a cash expense. It's just a tax return expense. And that fact, I think, is the critical fact as to why we pick partnerships / LLC as the choice of entity for real estate. Do you agree?
Yes, and part of that depreciation deduction was funded by whatever equity you had to put in, so
right.
That did functionally cost you money because you had to put in the equity. But the portion that's created by the portion of the purchase price for the real estate that was funded by the debt, that you're not out of pocket for. The bank came up with that money. And again, if it were not real estate, unless you guaranteed the debt, you typically would not be able to take those depreciation deductions once you ran out of the amount that's allocable to your equity piece. But as I've said a number of times already, and I'll say again, there's this special rule that applies only to non-recourse debt on real estate from traditional lenders. And in those cases, that non-recourse debt is permitted to fund depreciation deductions for which the members can use on their tax returns. Now, they may be separately subject to passive activity loss limitations, which, again, are subject of tomorrow's program. But so you may still be subject to those limitations. But as long as those limitations don't create a problem for you, real estate gives you a great opportunity to reduce your income from amounts that were funded by the bank, not by you.
Got it. So I think we've beat the horse of entity consideration to just about, for what it's worth. let's move over to the other big reason why the partnership slash LLC structure is so popular, and that is understanding allocation of tax and economic attributes. And let's talk a little bit about why we like that so much better than trying to write a corporation ownership structure and achieve the same results. And I think for most of us, the discussion starts with the fact that most real estate transactions on the financial level, Rick, involve a combination of investor class people who have money to invest and entrepreneurial class people who are more promoter oriented, and they go out and find the opportunities, assemble the opportunity, package it all up, and then take it to the investors. So in virtually every real estate transaction, modern real estate transaction that you'll see, there'll be investors and there'll be what we call the promoters, and you have to structure a return to both parties, but that return does not reflect the capital base that the two groups put in. Typically, the investors put up most, if not all, of the capital. The promoter puts in labor, work, effort, structuring, finding the opportunity, and so forth, what people commonly call sweat equity. And you have to have a structure that allocates return and incentive between those two groups. And Rick, that is very hard to do as a tax matter and as a corporate matter, doing that within corporations.
Talk
a little bit about that.
So again, the choice of entity issues that we've already discussed were mostly from the point of view of the investor. This is now a tax choice of entity consideration that deals with from the point of view of the promoter. As I think I mentioned earlier, you know, a C corporation, or as Tony mentioned, a C corporation pays its own taxes. An S corporation will pass through its allocates its income and losses to its shareholders, but again, subject to some limits that partnerships may not be subject to, as we discussed earlier. And then partnerships, similar to an S corporation, will also pass its income and losses up to its partners, but with a lot more flexibility than an S corporation is allowed to use. So from the point of view of the sponsor, what the sponsor likes about the partnership structure is that, one, they can get effectively a higher percentage of the residual value of the distributions, typically on sale, but not necessarily on sale, than the percentage of cash they put in. In a C corporation or an S corporation, if they got such an ownership interest without otherwise paying for it, that would be taxable to them.
On receipt.
On receipt of the stock. Whereas on receipt of a partnership that gives you a back end share, what we typically call either a profits interest, sometimes referred to as a promote, sometimes referred to as a carried interest, that under current tax rules, it's generally tax-free on receipt. So they may put in 1% of the capital, but after some return to the investors, let's say an 8% preferred return plus a return of capital, they may get 20% of the residual. That's one common structure. There are lots of other common structures that we'll discuss in a moment. And on receipt of that 20% promote or 20% profits interest or 20% carried interest, that is not taxable on receipt.
On the initial receipt. At the time of formation of the entity.
Exactly.
That's critical for folks to understand. When you form the entity at the beginning of the deal, the profits interest technically usually has a zero value.
At least on a liquidation basis.
On a liquidation basis, because if you liquidated it an hour after you formed it, you would sell it for what you just paid for it.
And the investors would just get their money back.
And investors would all get their money back. So the profits value, profits interest, has no real economic value as of the date of its receipt. That is critical.
But if you only get the benefit of that liquidation approach in a partnership, in a C-corp or an S-corp, Well, first of all, you couldn't do it in an S-corp because it would be a second class of stock and it would
right.
blow your S election.
Right.
So you couldn't even do something like that in an S-corp structure. If you try to mimic in a C-corp, you are required to value it. Even if it has no current liquidation value,
right.
you have to give it an option value or some sort of value.
Yeah.
So that's one critical benefit to the partnership structure, is that you can give them this profits interest, and it is not taxable on receipt. And as long as they hold it, used to be they only had to hold it for 1 year. Starting in 2018, another recent change in the latest tax law, you now have to hold the profits interest for 3 years to get capital gain treatment. But most real estate projects take more than 3 years before you've built up enough improvements into the property to want to sell it off anyways. So that's not that big of a limitation, but it does limit people's ability to do sort of, you know, if there's a quick pop in value, the promote may not get the best tax treatment if you sell it less than 3 years from when you formed the entity. But as long as you can wait the full 3 years, you get that long-term capital gain treatment, which segues into our second topic of tax allocations and attributes, which is that once you've created this structure that has whatever the waterfall distribution may be.
And you just used the term there. Let's pause for a second. Our listeners may not be as conversant in this as we are. When we use the term waterfall distribution, what we mean is it's typical in these real estate deals, particularly where you have these two classes, the entrepreneur class and the investor class, you have a splitting of the economic benefits, and that splitting typically takes place in layers or tranches is a fancy word for it. And so the common term in the industry is the waterfall. And what that means is the money cascades through the partnership from level to level to level. And that's why we use the term waterfall.
And each lower level, the promoter or the sponsor gets a larger share of the distribution.
So the bigger the pot, you take out a level first, typically for the investor. Then what's left, the next cut, the investor gets a little lesser share and the promoter gets a bigger share. And that keeps shifting usually until some point where you end up at 50-50 or some other relationship like that, depending
so,
on how big their gain is.
In my experience, Tony, you may have a different
yeah.
experience, but in my experience, there are two basic models. One is the model where the promoter sort of goes out and gets a bunch of little investors, what I'll loosely call a syndicated deal. In a syndicated deal, the waterfall usually is a little simpler. It's usually something like what I described before, an 8% preferred return, then a return of capital to the investors, then a 20% promote to the sponsor, and the 80% to the investors. And then sometimes if you hit a certain threshold of return, you may get to a higher promote. Like Tony suggested, sometimes it can go all the way up to a 50% promote. But in my experience, that's not that common. Usually in those syndicated deals, it's more like 20 to 30%, but they can vary. And in that sort of deal, the key is that the sponsor usually puts in minimal to no capital. The other model that I tend to see a lot of is that's the syndicated deal model, where really the sponsor is responsible for finding all the little investors. The other model is what I'll call the joint venture model. In the joint venture model, the sponsor simply partners with a fund, and the fund has done the work to go out and find all the little investors, pool them together, and the fund basically acts as a single investor. And in those deals, there are two major differences. One is that the sponsor typically has to come up with more capital rather than nominal. They usually come up with something like 10% of the capital. But the other main difference is that the waterfall tends to be much more complicated.
Yes.
And it'll be, you know, it goes 90-10 until you hit a certain IRR threshold.
Tell them what an IRR is.
So IRR is short for internal rate of return.
Right.
It's similar to preferred return. So preferred return is just like an interest rate. It's calculated the same as an interest rate. IRR is similar to an interest rate, but it typically is using daily compounding or continuous compounding, and it is essentially includes both the return of your capital and that interest rate all taken together in one calculation.
Correct.
To hit that IRR target.
Correct. And for the sake of the listeners, the IRR, internal rate of return, is a financial concept beyond the scope of this program. But if you're going to have a career in real estate, you better go learn what that means and how it's calculated and what the nuances of it are, because you're going to be grappling with it for the rest of your career.
But Excel does a pretty good job of calculating
it
for you. There's a function called XIRR that pretty much
does
the work.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do it by hand. What's key, though, with respect to the tax allocations is that there are, again, two different general approaches to how you allocate the tax allocations. So generally, the way, as we've said a number of times, the partnership itself is not what pays the taxes. They allocate the income and losses up to the partners. And let me step back for a second. When I say partnership, I will typically mean a limited liability taxed as a partnership. But for tax purposes, us tax lawyers, we just think of it as a partnership because that's what the tax law thinks of it as. So the partnership will allocate the income and loss to the partners. In general, the character in the hands of the partners is the same as the character recognized by the partnership. So if the partnership recognizes ordinary income, that they will allocate that ordinary income to the partners. If the partnership recognizes capital gain, they allocate the capital gain to the partners. But again, there are two different approaches to allocations. And again, they typically, one is typically used in the syndicated deals and the other in the JV deals. So in a syndicated deal, what you will typically use is what we tax lawyers tend to call the layer cake allocation approach. And what that is a very understandable approach that basically says, first, we allocate to the people who are earning the preferred return equal to the amount of their preferred return, and thereafter, we allocate based on people's residual percentages. And again, this is back to that simple case where it's, you know, like 8% preferred return to the investors, then return of capital, then 20% to the promoter, and 80% to the investors. So in that case, your first layer of allocations would be 8%, that 8% pref to the investors, and then you would go 20% of any additional allocations to the promoter, and the other 80% split among the investors. Notice, however, that the waterfall has a layer in it that the allocations do not have. That is a critical piece of information to understand.
And that layer is?
The return of capital.
Right.
So if you have a typical syndicated deal that's something like 8% pref to the investors, return of capital to the investors, and then 80-20,
That's how the cash is going,
but the tax allocations are going first to the investors to the 8%, but then once you run out of that, you go 80-20, how is the promoter going to pay his taxes or her taxes on the 20% of the residual income that may be allocated to the promoter?
Just so we're clear for listeners, the promoter in that case is getting, let's say the taxable income was $20 and the allocation of the 8% preferred return took up 12 of the 20. Now there's 8 left. 20% of that 8 just got allocated for tax purposes to the promoter. He got a K-1 tax return that says I got $1.60 of income allocated to me, but I didn't get any cash.
Because under the waterfall.
Under the cash waterfall.
100% of that has to go to the investors as
until they get their capital back.
Because they haven't gotten their capital back. Again, assuming they haven't yet gotten their capital back. If they had, then they'd be out of preferred return as well, because once you pay them back their capital, they don't earn a preferred return anymore. But typically, you're not going to get their capital back to them entirely until you sell the property. So that rarely happens. But in that case, where the normal waterfall would not give any cash to the promoter to pay their taxes on those allocations, what we usually add to the operating agreement, that agreement which tells us how the cash and the economics and the tax allocations, how all of that is taken care of as amongst all of the members of this LLC or all the partners of the partnership for tax purposes, is we usually add a tax distribution section, which basically says that we will distribute enough so that the promoter can pay their taxes. So you take that, in Tony's example, the $1.60, and you multiply it by some assumed rate, let's say 40%, and so you distribute to them at least that amount
of cash
so that they're not out of pocket to pay their taxes. And that seems relatively fair, because the only reason we picked the partnership structure was so that we would get the benefit of these depreciation deductions and the one level of tax so that you don't have a corporate level. Plus, what I didn't mention, of course, is that after the corporation pays its taxes in a C-corp, when it then pays dividends, that's also separately taxable to the shareholders, whereas a partnership, there's just the one level of tax, but it's paid by the partners. So it's fair to say, since we chose the partnership structure simply to allow us not to have to have those two levels of tax and to get the benefit of these depreciation deductions flowing through to the partners, it's fair that the partnership cover that tax cost. But it should not be extra money to the partner in the long run, so that eventually, I'm sorry, to the sponsor in the long run. So eventually, at the time at which the sponsor would otherwise be entitled to cash in excess of what they would need to cover their taxes, you basically back out those prior distributions and give them to the investors, so that when you look at the deal across all of the years, they don't get more cash than what the regular waterfall would have given them, but they might get it earlier. So if you consider time value of money, arguably the sponsor may be a little better off, although remember, they just use that cash to pay their taxes anyway.
Right.
And so it's not really that big of a deal on a time value of money basis.
At least not to the promoter.
Not to the promoter, maybe to the investors a little bit, but it's not like the promoter really got much of a benefit from that. But the investors, yes, the investors are out a little bit with respect to time value of money, but in the end, they won't be out any cash, because it will true up in the end if you've drafted the tax distribution section properly.
Right.
That's not to say I haven't reviewed some operating agreements written by other people that didn't necessarily do that
correctly.
But if drafted properly, that should all true up in the end.
Right.
Now, let me say, typically in the JV structure,
the joint venture
structure, which is the one where I said the fund pulls the money together, and the sponsor typically, instead of having nominal to no capital in the deal, has something more like 10% of the deal, the tax distribution provision is less common. And the reason for that is because the theory is you are supposed to have, they want the sponsor in that case to have more skin in the game. And so to the extent that there aren't enough, distributions that would otherwise go to the sponsor to cover, because remember, the sponsor is getting 10% of the distributions anyways. And so if there's not enough, whereas in the syndicated structure, the sponsor may be getting nothing during the return of capital tranche. Whereas in this situation, where the sponsor generally has to put in at least 10% of the capital, they're getting at least 10% of the distributions anyways. And the point is, if that's not enough to cover your taxes, well, then too bad for you. Most investors do not allow for tax distribution. Some do. I've done some joint venture deals where the investor group or the investor fund does allow it. But in most of those deals, they do not on the grounds that, you know, the cash flow should be good enough from your 10% to cover your taxes on the promote. And if it's not, well, then you just, you know, we don't want to have to come out of pocket for that. Time value money is very important to the fund because they have their own obligations that they have to their investors that are accruing its own IRR.
And their own waterfall.
And their own waterfall. So they're very concerned about time value of money, and they're less sympathetic to allowing for a tax distribution. So in a syndicated deal, I almost always see tax distributions, almost universally. In a JV deal, I'd say it's not unheard of. I have seen them, but they are uncommon.
Got it. Okay, I think we've dedicated enough discussion of our time, enough of our time to that discussion today. Hopefully that's clear as mud to everybody who is listening to it. I want to switch over to our next topic, though, and that is like-kind exchanges generally and some sort of advanced topics in respect to that. Section 1031 of the code, as we all know, says that if you sell a property that is basically a real estate investment type property, and you reinvest the proceeds within 6 months, 180 days of the time that you do the sale, you can exclude the capital gain on the sale and, in effect, roll that capital gain forward into the new investment property. And there are all these restrictions about you have to designate your property within 45 days, and you have to you can designate up to three, as I recall, and, you know, all those rules. That's not really what I want to talk about today. What I want to talk about are some special situations involving like-kind exchanges. And the first one is the whole reason that you have this deferred ability to, with the six-month rule and so forth, is that as a practical matter in the real world, it's very, very difficult. And I can't think of once in the last 30 years where we were able to actually affect a simultaneous like-kind exchange. And this was before the new rules came in that allow you to do the deferred rules. It was just very, very difficult structurally to find a property that you were going to sell, be able to get it under contract to sell it, find what you were going to buy, and link them up so that the closings would occur simultaneously. So the fact that 1031 was amended over the years to allow you to do these deferred exchanges was a good thing because it made it feasible and practical to do that. But the reality is, because it's unlikely that you're going to be able simultaneously to do the sell first and then buy, Rick, the first big issue comes up with in the what I call the advanced topic is what happens when the property that you want to buy has to be bought and closed on before you can sell. In other words, the seller of the property that you want is insisting on a closing that is prior to the date that you're able to sell. So you instead of sell, then buy, we need to buy and then sell. Rick, talk us through that one.
So there are two general categories of situations that we will discuss that deal with the buy before you sell situation. The most basic is where the property that you're buying is already developed, right? You're just buying a different property, but for whatever reason, you haven't yet found a buyer for the property you want to sell, and if you don't buy that property now, you're going to lose it. For that situation, they almost 20 years ago came out with a safe harbor revenue procedure that sets forth a bunch of rules for how you can buy a property and eventually
qualify it.
Allow that property to qualify as the property that you're treated as acquiring in a 1031 exchange. And they require you to have an accommodation title holder that is technically the owner of that property during this up to 180-day period, and they're treated as the tax owner, even though you may have all of the indicia of ownership, which under normal tax analysis would treat you as the owner.
Not the entity.
Not this accommodation title holder as the entity, but as long as you comply with this safe harbor, they allow you to pretend like all of those normal tax principles that would recharacterize ownership from the technical title holder to you and allow you to treat the title holder as the owner during this period, so that when you finally get to sell the property, as long as you meet all these tests in terms of what they allow you to do with respect to their, you're allowed to lease the property, you're allowed to guarantee the loan on the property. So they do a lot of things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do to facilitate the transaction and not be treated as the tax owner while you, even though you have all of the indicia of ownership as if you own the property, while you go out and market the property you want to sell. And then once you do that, then you go through the steps that look like a normal 1031, so that technically the 1031 under the code happens when you sell the property and only begins then. But you really started it, you know, up to 180 days earlier when you functionally bought the replacement property, even though for tax purposes they pretend that you didn't buy it by going through all of these safe harbor rules.
All right, so that's advanced like-kind exchange, buy and then sell 202. Now I want to do advanced like-kind exchange, buy and then sell 303, which is what happens if you buy the property and you have to make improvements to it to operate your business. And Rick and I have been through a number of these. This is a common problem for companies that have, say, industrial or production type uses. The property that they're buying typically doesn't have the attributes in terms of equipment and layout and so forth that the company, the selling company, needs to operate its business. And you can't sell and buy and then build the building because you're out of the possession, typically, of the property you sold. Now, one way around that may be you sell the property and lease it back for some period of time, but you're still up against the six-month rule and all of that. So talk for a second, Rick, about what do you do with your intermediate entity that is the buyer of the property when, in fact, that entity now just doesn't hold the property waiting for the sale, but actually has to make improvements to it.
Right. And by the way, the problem isn't just what you said, but also the only thing that will qualify for the like-kind exchange is the condition of the property as you buy it. The additional proceeds that you want to use to develop in a normal straight sale-then-buy situation can't be used to build.
Right.
So if you are absolutely 100% confident that you can get all of your development funds fully expended and incorporated into the property before the 180 days is up, you can do the same sort of transaction that I described before under the safe harbor, where you buy the property, but you're not treated as the tax owner yet, even though you have all indicia of ownership that would under normal circumstances treat you as the tax owner, because the tax law doesn't always care who's the title holder. They care who has the benefits and burdens of ownership. So you may have the benefits and burdens of ownership, but you've complied with all these safe harbor rules so that the accommodation title holder is treated as the tax owner. And if they, during this six-month period, can incorporate all of the improvements into the building, or at least as much as you need to use for your exchange, because let's say you're selling a building worth $2 million and you're buying the building, you know, the new building to build is going to cost $3 million, so you're buying the land for, let's say, $500,000 and you're going to put another $2.5 million into it. You need to make sure that you get at least $1.5 million in by the end of the 180 days.
To shelter the full $2
million. To shelter the full $2 million of what you sold.
That's critical, everybody. Pay attention to that.
And understand, under basic, so this is back to like-kind 101 or maybe 102,
yeah,
is that in a normal like-kind exchange, when you sell the property, you have to cover both the equity and the debt.
Right.
Equity has to be covered by new equity. Debt has to be covered by debt, by new debt or new equity. But you've got to cover both the debt and the equity in terms of the net sale proceeds.
And if you ever have a like-kind exchange in which you are taking money off the table, so to speak, by reducing the debt call the tax lawyer. That is a very complicated analysis, and it's tricky, and they have a number of examples in the regulations, and you have got to grind your actual numbers through those examples to get the right answer, and it's not intuitive, correct?
Correct, but we're getting a little off track from the buy then sell.
Right.
So in the buy then sell situation, again, if you can get that incorporated into the building by the end of the 180-day period and make sure you can also sell by the end of that 180-day period, you're golden. But just because you've bought stuff that's going to be incorporated into the building, it doesn't count. If you have huge steel beams sitting on the property that's still personal property under state law rules of what's personal property and what's real property, and it's still personal property, that's no good. It has to be attached to the real property and become real property for state law purposes. Once that steel is attached to the building, it changes its character from personal property to real property, and now that value can be used as part of the exchange. But when it's sitting on the side of the property waiting to be installed into the building, it's still personal property, and it cannot be part of the like-kind exchange.
Rick, the other big topic in advanced exchanges, I think, and we're pressing now against a deadline here, but just quickly, talk about ticks in just a few minutes.
Before I get to ticks, I just want to finish this topic because I preluded it and didn't complete it, which is that, so if you can't get all that done within 180 days, then you probably have to try a non-safe harbor, which in 30 seconds basically means you get some friendly party to buy the property, but they have to have the benefits and burdens of ownership, which means that ultimately you can't have a fixed price at the end of the day, because then you haven't shifted, then that person doesn't have the benefits and burdens of ownership. So that person has to take some risk, and then at the end of, once the building is built, then the building can be part of a 1031, and presumably that friendly party gets some profit from that.
Right.
But they also have to take some risk for that to work, and so that can be hard to make work.
All right, 30 seconds, just a couple minutes on, this is important. One of the 1031 rules is specific legislation says this, you cannot change a partnership interest or evidence of ownership, whether it's stock or partnership, for similar evidence of ownership. So you cannot, as a practical matter, you cannot trade in a 1031 a partnership interest for a partnership interest.
Even if the sole asset of each partnership is only like-kind property.
Correct. So if you have a partner in a partnership who wants to get out, but they don't want to pay tax, they want to trade their interest into something else, it's not unusual to do the following, which we call tenants in common transactions.
Right. So one thing that you also might want to know is that prior to the new tax bill, personal property of like kind was eligible for like kind exchange treatment. That is no longer true. It's now only real estate. So that makes these like-kind exchanges a little more expensive than they used to be in a situation where you have a combination of real estate and personal property, and it makes the personal property exchanges completely off the table. But now on to the ticks. What often happens...
Tick is short for tenants in common.
Right. So right, TIC, tick, tenant in common. So if you have a LLC tax as a partnership and all of the partners want to participate, no problem. That's back to like-kind exchange 1031, class 101, where the partnership simply sells the property, puts it in an escrow, finds another property to buy, uses the escrow funds to buy the property, and now the partnership owns a new property. No problem. But what happens if that's not the case? Some partners want to engage in a like-kind exchange and some just want to take their money off the table and spend it. They want to go to Tahiti with the money. So what you have to do is create a tick structure. The way you do that is what we commonly refer to in the industry as a drop and swap. So a drop and swap means you drop the property out of the partnership and into the hands of the individual partners. Now, let me step back for a second and give you a non-tax consideration, which is people are saying, whoa, I don't want to be an individual owner of real estate. I don't want environmental issues, whatever. They can form their own single-member LLC, treated as a disregarded entity for tax purposes, and receive their share of the property in that LLC so that that LLC is treated as the TIC owner, and then they are still shielded from a liability standpoint with that LLC, but for tax purposes, they will be treated as the direct owner of that tenant in common ownership structure. And then all of the different partners will have their pro rata share based on the waterfall. You run through the waterfall, you value the property, run through the waterfall, distribute out, and each partner gets their pro rata percentage interest as a tenant in common. You're going to have some sort of co-owner agreement, which is going to be similar to the partnership or operating agreement, but it can't have that complex waterfall. Everybody just has to have a straight percentage interest in the property. And it has to be done before you have a contract to sell. Because if you already have a contract to sell, then what's called the step transaction is going to ignore the distribution out to the members, what I call the drop.
They're
going to
say
the
that
drop
was, that
will
was,
be ignored, and they'll treat it as if the partnership directly sold it because you were already under contract to sell. But if you distribute it out, if you drop it to the members or partners before you are under contract, before you have a set deal, they take what in the tax law referred to as entrepreneurial risk that they may not get the price they think they're going to get. And if they take that, quote, entrepreneurial risk, they will be treated as the owner of the tenant in common interest, and then when all the tenants in common sell to the person, each person is treated as selling their pro rata portion of the real estate, not a sale of partnership interest anymore. And so some can choose to have their share of the funds put into a 1031 escrow and use it to fund a 1031, and others can take the money and go to Tahiti or do whatever they want with
right.
it.
Now, the problem with that, as you alluded to it briefly, is that you go from having a partnership agreement or an LLC operating agreement that discusses somebody's typically the manager and is in charge of the day-to-day, and all the other partners have their partnership share. You now have, instead of having one entity owning a property, you now have, let's say you had 10 members or partners, and let's just keep it simple, each one owns one-tenth, you now have 10 separate owners of the property, each as to an undivided one-tenth interest as a tenant in common, and you almost have to have an operating agreement between those tenants in common.
Well, what you have is what's called a co-owners agreement, right, or a tenant in common ownership agreement or some other title or different titles, and there is a safe harbor revenue procedure out there that tells you what can be in that co-owner agreement without the co-owner agreement itself being treated for tax purposes as creating a new partnership,
right,
which is why I had said before that you can't have a complex waterfall. That safe harbor document makes it pretty clear that at least if you want to qualify for the safe harbor, everybody just has to have a straight percentage ownership.
Right.
Now, you can pay somebody a management fee to manage the property, so the guy that used to be the sponsor can now be the property manager and get a property management fee of some kind, but you're much more limited in what can be in that co-owner agreement without risking recreating a partnership and being back in the 1031 soup that we were trying to avoid.
Correct. So, Rick, in the last couple minutes before we take questions, let's talk for a minute about what our experience has been with the tenant in common transactions. And by the way, after the real estate crash in 2009, there were a lot of these trying to be put together. They almost uniformly all were not successful.
Right.
And the reason is these issues of the common agreement became very difficult to deal with. Is that a fair summary?
That is a situation we haven't really discussed yet. That's where you're trading into a tenant in common situation. So that's actually a converse situation we haven't discussed, which is that you've been operating a property for a long time. You're sick of doing it. You want to just basically 1031 into something you don't have to think about again.
So you want to sell your Walgreens, not pay the income
tax.
Well,
no. You want to sell your apartment building that you've been running and trade into
a
Walgreens that is basically a triple net lease that you don't worry about. That was the typical tenant in common situation.
Yeah.
And those situations, you don't see that many anymore.
Right.
Because it turns out that the fees that the promoters are taking to put together these Walgreens and whatever other structure it is that you're trading into makes it so that you're better off in most situations just paying your tax and walking away.
Right.
But the situation that I described is still viable, which is where you're only a tenant in common for a short period of time. And that can still work. And those we still see from time to time where you have people who are members of an LLC and some want to do a 1031 and some don't. But what we're seeing less and less of are the situations where people want to trade from actively managed real estate to passively managed real estate.
In partnership with a bunch of people you don't even
know. Well, the only way you can do that is in a tenant income. There's no way that you can transition into a solely owned piece of real estate that you don't in some respect actively manage. It just isn't going to work from a practical standpoint. Somebody's got to
run
the property.
All right. So I believe it's time to open the program to questions from our listeners. Operator, would you please provide our listeners with instructions on how they can ask their questions?
If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touch-tone phone, followed by the 1 key. That's star 1. When you do, you will be told your place in line. To get out of the queue, just press the pound key. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Thank you, operator. Rick, while we're waiting for any listener questions, let's just talk for another second or two about So if you're in an existing partnership that wants to convert to the tenant in common form in order to effect a transfer out, what I think we were saying earlier is be very careful about trading into a TIC structure where someone has taken a piece of real estate in order to facilitate people coming in with trade proceeds. That's really what we're talking about.
Yes. Is
people, and this is what happened. Promoters went out there and they bought a shopping center or they bought an office building typically, and they said, gee, here's an opportunity. You know, Ma and Pa own a little, I keep using Walgreens. It could be a Pizza Hut. It could be, I have a client who owns a bunch of Pizza Huts. And you could sell your single asset entity and trade into a share of a shopping center or an office building. Those routinely didn't work out very well for the reasons that we were discussing, correct?
Right. So what typically happened in those deals, and they were really popular before the recession, the Great Recession, is that people, like I said, the most classic case, the prototypical case was somebody was operating an apartment building that they owned for years, and they were, you know, they may have hired a guy, you know, to live on site and do the management on a day-to-day basis, but they still had to do a lot of oversight to make sure that they were hiring the right person and to make sure that they weren't cheating them, et cetera. So they were sick of having to manage a piece of property, and they wanted to get the tax benefit of 1031 but not have to worry about it. And so the prototypical case was they would sell and they would go into one of these TIC properties, which again, the prototypical one when I would go to these seminars was a Walgreens. A triple net lease Walgreens was the classic case. But again, you still have to have somebody to put together the deal and somebody to oversee the transaction between the Walgreens and all these tenants, and that would be the promoter. And so the promoter would suck out a bunch of fees. And to make the structure work, the co-ownership agreement would sort of name them as the manager, and you would have some ability to replace them periodically, the owners to replace them. But they knew that the owners never really were going to bother to go out and find somebody else to replace them unless they really screwed things up. So they just kept collecting fees year after year. And it turned out that two things happened. One, enough of these had been in place that enough people started to see that they weren't really paying off for the owners, just for the promoters, and they would have been just as well, if not better off, just paying their tax and taking their money off the table. But two, when the Great Recession happened and property values crashed, it really, so many of these tenants, went bankrupt or different things happened that created economic distress for these people. And they were stuck owning a fractional interest in a building whose value went way down.
And typically with a bunch of other owners they had never met, never talked to, didn't know, may not have common interests with, and so forth. That was really, I think, one of the big problems. Operator, do we have any questions yet?
No, we do not.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. I believe that's all the time we have today. If you were not able to ask your question or one occurs to you later, our contact information has been provided on your written materials, and you should feel free to contact Rick or myself at any time, and we're happy to answer your questions. This is Tony Licata, and on behalf of Rick Aderman and myself, thank you for joining us today.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's program.